Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we will talk about giving we the people a more effective voice in government. So often we feel that our voice and our vote doesn't matter. We feel drowned out by the rare few who can give big donations to candidates for office. Our government is dominated by special interests, and Congress is stymied by gridlock. How can the voice of citizens be heard over the loud roar of big funders? How do we get beyond gridlock so our government can function better for the people? Here to talk with us today is someone who says he has a solution to these problems. Stephen Cull is founder and president of Voice of the People, a new nonpartisan organization that seeks to re-anchor our democracy in its founding principles by giving we the people a more effective voice in policymaking. He is a public opinion expert who has worked for two decades with policymakers in the U.S. Congress and the executive branch to facilitate their understanding of the views of the American people. He is a director of the Program for Public Consultation, a joint program of the Center on Policy Attitudes and the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. Stephen Cull, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks for having me.
So take it from the top here. Tell us about Voice of the People. What is it? When did you start it? Why was it started? And what's its mission?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned, I've been working for the last two decades on trying to improve the communication between the public and policymakers, working with staffers on the Hill and some members directly as well as people in the executive branch. And what we found is that policymakers really have a very poor understanding of what the public really has to say. The public is really having very little impact on public policy. Now, we have gradually developed a new method that for surveying the public that proved to be more effective in giving the public a real focused way to get at policy questions. Now, when you do a standard poll, for one, people often don't have the correct information. For example, there was a point a few 15 years ago where there was polling showing that the people thought we were spending too much on foreign aid. But when we asked people how much they thought was going to foreign aid, the median estimate was 20% of the budget, and when in fact it was 1%. And when we asked them what they thought it should be, they thought it should be 10% on average. So far more than it actually was. And we said, well, how would you feel if it was 1%? They thought, that's probably not enough. So one key thing is to really give effective input into policy. It's important for people to have better information. So that's we developed a method we call a policymaking simulation, where a representative sample will go through this process where they get briefed on the issues so that they're dealing with the real facts. Then they're presented the options, and the policy options, and for those we then give them a pro and a con argument, and those are developed together with congressional staffers. Finally, they make their recommendations, and often in a context where they have to deal with trade-offs. So the input that they're making is really targeted at the choice points that Congress is dealing with, and it's based on correct information. And we have talked with congressional staffers at length, and they go, wow, this would be really useful. This would really make a difference if we had this kind of input.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. So you're basically trying to inform citizens about what's really happening and then ask for their views on, you know, given what's going on here, how do you think we should be moving forward here? How should the people in Congress be voting? Is that right?
That's right.
You know, I'm thinking...
Now there's one more step in this, though, which is that it. Now most surveys are done with just, you know, about, say, 800 or 1,000 people nationwide, and from that you know what the country as a whole thinks. But to really influence members of Congress, You actually have to hear, they have to hear from their constituents. So the idea is to also create what's called, and this is actually the biggest part of the idea, to create what's called a citizen cabinet. And this would have a few hundred people in each district and state that would go through these policy-making simulations and give these members of Congress input directly to their representatives.
Yeah, you know, thinking as you're describing this, we need a process like this for people who are members of Congress. I mean, it shocks me when I hear members of Congress making statements about critical public matters like the global warming crisis, and they totally have their facts all screwed up. I mean, I understand you can have a liberal perspective or a conservative perspective or green or whatever your perspective is, but at least it should be grounded in facts. You know, so what do we do about making sure that members of Congress are fact-based in their decision-making?
Well, one of the big values of this process is that by developing this policy-making simulation, we're finding a kind of a shared set of facts between people with different perspectives from both parties and from also outside groups. These are these simulations are developed in consultation with the whole spectrum of viewpoints. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we find that we are able to find consensus on what the basic facts are, and then each side gets to make their strongest argument, pro and con. So, and these are full-throated arguments, and so on. So the differences come out in the expression of the arguments, but then we end up though with the briefing being the point of agreement, and we find that we are able to do that. And that's one of the values of these simulations, is then you have a kind of shared discourse, a shared framework that to have this discussion in.
So is the hope that the constituents are going to be fact-based and then think it through and make their decision and then come together in some kind of a way, and then the constituents would reach their members of Congress? Is that the idea?
Well, there are two aspects of it. One is that, first of all, let me mention that we have been doing this. It's not something we're proposing to do from scratch. We have, over the last 20 years, been developing these methods. And we have done these with national samples. And people are able to go through these processes and absorb significant information and solve a lot of problems. We did one on Social Security recently where three-quarters of Republicans and Democrats agreed on steps to eliminate most of the Social Security shortfall, the problem that Social Security is having in terms of paying for itself in the future. So we know that these actually work. But what we haven't done is do it at the state and district level, which means that we have to build them out with many more people as part of it.
So when you say that you've been doing this for 20 years now, and I've been tracking a little the work you've done on the Social Security, because that is, you know, as everybody knows, a big battleground between left and right, Democrats
right.
and Republicans. And you have, you know, some of the people on the Republican side say, well, we don't have enough money. It's going to go short. You actually have some people who say, let's do away with Social Security. Or at the minimum, let's cut back on benefits. Let's extend the amount of time a person lives before they can qualify for it. So kind of shrinking the program in whatever way. But I think what you just said is startling, that you have already been working with citizens and giving them basic facts about here's the situation financially with Social Security. And when you brought the citizens together in some kind of a national sampling from across the political spectrum, that you got 75% of the citizens to agree on how to deal with the Social Security situation. Did
right.
I hear
I would
you right?
Say I got them to do it. We just gave them the options, and individually they went through it, and they came up with their recommendations. And basically, there was a convergence between what the Republicans and Democrats said about the basic steps to deal with the problem.
So
it turns out that when people are presented the, you know, if you throw ideological statements that people, you can get, you get these very divided responses. But when you get down to the question of, okay, here's a problem, here are the options for solving it, very objectively, here's how much each one helps and so on, then people tend to reason in a much more similar way than you would expect.
Yeah, so, you know, the obvious question I'm sure our listeners are asking are, you know, what's the magic solution here? What are the steps that we need to take to deal with Social Security? What did the people come up with?
Well, it was a combination of things. They had options to raise the retirement age, to raise the cap on income subject to the payroll tax, an option to do a kind of means testing to benefits so that the people in the top 25% of income don't get quite as much more as they currently get more. It's not that they were they got less than others, but right now they get significantly more, and so that was sort of tapered off a bit. And then they raised the payroll tax rate just a little bit. They raised the retirement age about a year, and then they raised the amount of income subject to the payroll tax a significant amount. So you put all those together, and you solve that gets that solves more than 70% of the Social Security shortfall.
So that sounds like a sensible plan. I mean, I think some people might quibble with some aspects of that, but on the whole, that sounds like it's still very reasoned. And how long has it been since this solution has emerged from your process with Citizens?
Well, we did that about, what was it, a year ago, a little over a year ago on that one. But we've done other ones with the federal budget where people presented the federal budget, and then they get a chance to say what they think the federal budget should be.
And we've done
ones where they are presented the negotiations with Iran, and they get to hear the different proposals for how we should deal with that situation, and hear the pro and con arguments and so on.
So here's my question: you've come up with this solution, which, you know, a lot of people, you're saying three-quarters of the people agree on. You've had the solution for a year. What kind of traction are you getting in Congress when you go and say, hey, guys, you may not have figured this out in Congress, but, you know, we the people have figured this out, so here's what we can do, and you'll have broad support if you do this. What kind of response have you gotten among members of Congress?
Well, the response tends to be, well, that's very interesting, you know, those are still not my constituents. Mm-hmm. I really need to hear from my constituents for it to really make a difference. If, you know, I've got people leaning on me this way and that way, trying to, you know, making these demands, those demands on this subject, and you know, for it to really make a difference for the people, in a sense, to be a player. They have to be my constituents, and that's when we developed the idea, that's how we developed the idea of the citizen cabinet, that we actually have to have a few hundred in each district and state.
That would mean to have
over 130,000 nationwide, 130,000 people, that would be part of it.
Okay, so you've got this process for having people learn about the facts and situations and possibilities on different policy issues like Social Security and the federal budget. You've now seen over 20 years that this process can actually work and you can get people to some common agreement on solutions, but we're still missing the step of members of Congress going, hey, that's a great idea, let's do that. And what you're seeing is that there's a need for the constituents, for each member of Congress to say, this is what we in your district want to have. So that led you to the idea of starting to create these citizen cabinets at a state level.
Is state that, and district, yeah.
State and district level. Is that kind of where you're at?
Mm-hmm. Well, where we're at right now is that we're in the process of building the first three states. And those are going to be Oklahoma, Maryland, and Virginia, a very Republican state, a very Democratic state, and then a state that's more evenly divided, or you could say blue, red, and purple.
Mm-hmm. So you're actually starting to build a citizen cabinet in each of those three states.
That's right.
So tell us some more about this idea of a citizen cabinet, because we, you know, we think about the federal government cabinet, the Secretary mm-hmm. of Labor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What is a citizen cabinet, and how are you putting that together?
Well, the idea is that, you know, the president has a cabinet, or sometimes they say a president might have a kitchen cabinet, or a member of Congress could have a kitchen cabinet made up of some, you know, leading members of their in their community. But this idea is to have a kitchen cabinet, so that a member of Congress is advised by a representative sample of their constituents. So the people are selected using, you know, standard survey methods to get a representative sample, so that it's it mirrors the population as a whole of the district or state. And then they agree to be part of this for a while, and then they're connected by the Internet. If people don't have Internet access, they're provided it, and then every few weeks they go through one of these processes, one of these policy-making simulations, and then the responses are, you know, aggregated and summarized and then presented to the congressional office, and then to the media, and made available publicly.
So it's basically a cabinet for each member of Congress. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of think of it as one big cabinet, but that with each, you know, you could say that each one has their own cabinet, or that it's one big cabinet that's big enough so that every member can hear from their own.
Okay, so you'd have one cabinet for the whole state delegation.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a few hundred in every district, then you'd have plenty for the whole, so that the person is, in a sense, part of the district one and part of the state one and part of the national one. So it's all kind of one big thing.
Okay, so that makes sense. So you're going to start with one for each state, and then as
right.
this continues to grow, you could actually get down to the level of each congressperson's district.
That's right. And we're going to do one district in Virginia, and one district in one district in Maryland, and one district in Oklahoma as well.
Well, that's certainly an ambitious undertaking. Now, how long is that going to take, do you think, for you to get this rolled out across the country?
Well, that depends on a lot of things. I don't think that's imminent. We're planning on step by step building out more and more states. Now, ultimately, our goal is to have a congressionally chartered national academy that would run the citizen cabinet for the whole country, a national academy for public consultation, we propose calling it. And then that this would manage it, and Congress would charter it, and at least provide some of the funding for it, and then but it would probably have some private funding as well.
Very interesting. So, you know, it's one of the things that's going to be getting some scrutiny, I'm sure, is who is selected, and you said there's going to be kind of a scientific process for selecting the members of the cabinet at each state and maybe eventually each district. How exactly are they selected? How do you know that that's going to be representative? And, you know, people can get very sensitive about this given how much, you know, people who influence policymakers tend to be often influenced themselves by special interests. So mm-hmm. how do you make sure this is truly a broad representation
right.
of the population?
You know, the whole sampling process is something that many people find very mysterious, and it's really understandable. How do you choose a few hundred people out of a few hundred thousand or even many millions and in a way so that you can be confident that the answers they give are roughly the same answers that you would get if you asked everybody in that population? But in fact, it does work, and that's why polls are really very good, for example, at predicting election outcomes within a pretty narrow margin of error. Within just a few percentage points at the most, they are able to predict election outcomes. So the key part of it is that there's there are these stages in the process. But let me just describe a little bit what it's like when you're doing one of these things.
You mean as if you were a member of a citizen cabinet?
No, no. I mean, like we have been doing surveys for many years, and you know, the first, if you first get a sample of the population of say 100, 150, and the first night you run them, and you get a certain ratio of say it's 60 one way, 40 the other. And then you add another 100, 150 the next day. And then it adds up to, it moves to 63, 50, 37.
Well, yeah,
another night. And then it gets closer and closer. And then after all, you realize that it doesn't really matter how many nights you do this. You can go on forever, and it'll get a little, it'll get a little more precise, but it's in a very narrow window, very narrow margin. So it's surprising that with a small number like that and just doing them a few hundred a night for a number of nights, you after it gets very stable very soon, and then you know that it doesn't matter how long I do this,
So the bottom line is you believe you've got a solid process which could give a scientific representation of the views of the people in that state or in that district.
Yeah, but this is nothing original. I mean, survey research is going on all over the country all the time. There are billions of dollars in market research and polling and all that, and these methods have been refined.
Right.
They have been well demonstrated, and I know they're counterintuitive, but they do work. What you have basically is a microcosm. Try to imagine that here's the whole population, and then there's a small population, but it's just the same in terms of the demographic breakouts, males to females, levels of education, levels of income, race, all those factors, and it's a perfect little microcosm of the whole population.
When you have that level of diversity, assuming that the process gets you to kind of a fair representation of the people and the views mm-hmm. in that state and in that mm-hmm. district, mm-hmm. How do you handle the fact that, clearly there'll be diametrically opposed views, because you'll have diehard Republicans, you'll have very progressive Democrats, you'll have Greens, you'll have everybody, and they won't agree. So how do you resolve the differences of views in order for the citizen cabinet to be able to make a recommendation to their representative in Congress?
Right. Well, it can happen that the public is divided and that there isn't a clear dominant recommendation. However, we have found that's rarely the case. For most issues, once you give people the right tools, they do tend toward finding a kind of common ground between Republicans and Democrats on many, many issues. Again, if you give people broad questions like, well, what's more important, cutting the deficit or making jobs or something like that, you can get a split between the Republicans and Democrats. But when you get down to the very specific questions about what government should actually do, they tend to arrive at more similar conclusions, enough so that you actually see a pretty clear kind of consensus emerging that represents a clear majority of the population as a whole.
That is fascinating. I'd love to see that play. And what kinds of topics will the Citizen Cabinet cover?
Oh, you know, what we should do, what kind of budget we should have. It'll deal with some topics that are not so, the people don't have all that much information about, like what should we do about the Postal Service. The Postal Service is having difficulties. What should we do about energy? What should we do about poverty? Things like that.
So the big question, because we all know that there's the big funders and their influence there on the current members of Congress, with some spectacular exceptions, but undue influence of special interest money there. How do you think the Citizen Cabinet is going to go toe-to-toe? Take the energy for an example. I think we already have a clear majority of people in the United States would support energy conservation, energy efficiency, and the more development of renewables, and yet we're still funding to the tunes of billions and billions, subsidizing ExxonMobil and the fossil fuel industries, who are already the most wealthy corporations ever created, and yet we taxpayers tend to keep subsidizing them because of their interest and influence over members of Congress. So how do you beat that?
Right. Well, let's just talk broadly about the role of special interests. And there's no question special interests have had a growing effect on members of Congress, and they'll say so themselves.
Actually, Steve, I'm sorry. I'm going to need to have you hold that thought and get your response after the break. We're going to pause now for a break. This is Eleanor LaCane speaking with my guest, Stephen Cull, the founder and president of Voice of the People. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane speaking with my guest, Stephen Cull, the founder and president of Voice of the People. We were talking before the break about how the Citizen Cabinets could counter the influence of special interests in Washington, D.C. So, Stephen, why would members of Congress listen to average citizens when they really need the money from the big donors to get reelected?
Right. Well, what do they need that money for? They need that money so that they can buy ads and compete in an election. It's not for them personally. It's for their campaigns. That's where the money gets directed. And who votes in the campaigns? Well, the citizens, right? So this is a way for them to get a clear sense of what the people have to say. Now, we have had over 65 meetings on the Hill about this idea with high-level congressional staffers. And they say that if we knew what our constituents have to say on an issue, and there's a special interest that's trying to prod us in a particular direction, we would be able to stand up to them and say, can't do that because of what our constituents are saying. So it would make it more difficult for the special interest to push them around. I mean, think about it. If a special interest gives money to a candidate and says, okay, here's the position you're supposed to take, then it's really hard for constituents to know that that's even happening. But if it's clear what the public in that district or state is saying, and the member is not doing that, then people will go, gee, well, how come, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe that member really does believe in that the policy that is also the one the special interest wants, and if that is the case, then he or she can explain it, and people respect that. If they don't say that you should always do exactly what the citizens say, if you strongly believe in something. But if it's really just a question of you know, going along with special interest to get that donation, then it would be more difficult. It would kind of shine a bright light on it, and it would increase the political costs of going with the special interest when it's clear what the people are saying. Now, of course, all this is dependent on local media paying attention to it, and we have had quite a few meetings now with media and local media, and they're very interested in this, finding out what the local constituents say. So it would be a factor. It would be in the picture. And the congressional staffers think that, and the local media would be, you know, is ready to play. So we're fairly confident that if the voice of the people locally is clear, and it was pointing in a direction that was different from where the special interests wanted things to go, that it would increase the likelihood that the member would go that way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that, and you've put your finger on, I think, what is truly the solution to the money-influencing politics problem, and that solution is, as you say, why do the candidates need the money? They need it for their campaigns to get reelected, and to get reelected, they need to get the votes, and those votes come from the people registered
exactly.
And voting in their district. So
right.
To anyone who, which is everybody I know, concerned about money in politics, a big part of the solution there is having educated, registered people who vote and who know and are informed about the candidates so that they're voting for someone who, you know, they believe in, who represents their point of view, and
mm-hmm.
that includes voting in primaries, which mm-hmm. it's shocking this year watching the primaries across the country where something like 80% of the registered voters are not turning up to vote in the primaries. So hopefully it'll be better on election day, but that's really the answer. You know, there's lots of other things, but to counter the money, you get the votes because they need the money to get the votes. That's the
right.
whole point. But
right.
if they don't get the votes because they're voting the wrong way, we can vote them out and bring in some other people. So,
right. But they need to, right now, the citizens can virtually, the way they communicate with their member is just through this up-down vote, you know, once every 2 to 6 years. And that's a very simple and crude method for communicating. And the founders never had in mind that that was the only way that the citizenry was going to express itself. They had put a lot of emphasis on the importance of members of Congress having a real connection with their constituents. Now, when Congress was first started in the 18th century, there was each member of Congress only represented about 20,000-25,000 people. That's like a small village, and they were there half the time. They were in Washington only half the time. So they really kind of could get to know their constituents. But now the congressional district is 500,000 to 900,000 people, and they're in Congress and they're in Washington most of the time. So they don't have a real way, good way of knowing what the people are really thinking. And this would create a means for the people to communicate. Now, I should mention something really important. Beside the citizen cabinet, when these simulations are developed, they'll also be put online so that anybody can use it as a means to get better informed on the issues Congress is dealing with, and then to communicate through this method, so that they could go through the simulation at the end. They
well,
have an opportunity to write a letter and send it to their member and you know, just email it right out.
Before you go on with that, you're talking about that there's no way for a member of Congress to really know what the citizens are thinking. But in my experience, members of Congress often are the best people who know what's going on because they're often out in their district. They have, you know, their district offices. They have frequent visits back. They're, you know, not always, and there are some members of Congress who don't even have a house back in the state that they're representing. But in general, they have their ear to the ground pretty well. There's lots of polling now that shows, I mean, things like, for example, polls showing 92% of Americans support checks before someone with a mental health history problem can get a license to buy a firearm. So 92% of Americans support that, including, by the way, a big majority of the NRA, the National Rifle Association. Even they have big majorities supporting that. And yet, because of the money from the NRA in Congress in terms of funding opponents, people in Congress are often afraid to vote, even after Sandy Hook, after Gabby Giffords in the assassination attempt. The members of Congress, even when they know what their members of their constituents are thinking, they don't vote that way because they're afraid of the money running in opposition against them in the next campaign.
Well, there are a lot of national polls that show that, but there were a lot of cases where Kelly Ayotte and Heidi Heitkamp said, you know, I'm in favor of background checks, but you know, the calls and letters I get are overwhelmingly against it, so I have to vote against it. And the way they focus on it is by looking at the calls and letters that they get, and those tend to be orchestrated by interest groups like the NRA, and so we have done research on it. Others have done research on it. Members really don't know what's going on. They know what's coming at them, but what's coming at them is generally represents organized interests. So they don't have good mechanisms by which the people can communicate.
So you think if we had a process like this, we would give some backbone to legislators to finally pass some sensible gun control legislation?
I think that's real possible. I think that it would increase the likelihood, and I mean, particularly on something like background checks, that where there have, Mayor Bloomberg did sponsor some polling in a lot of districts and found that even in districts where the member voted against it, there was very strong support. But it was not in a form that people had full confidence in. And it's also something else that happens that we encounter is that members will say, well, okay, there's a poll that said that, but they don't understand this problem. They didn't hear this key argument, and as soon as they hear that key argument, they'll move away from it. Well, that's one of the things that we do in our process is they hear all the pro and con arguments, so they can know that it's not just an off-the-cuff response, that it's a really considered response. And if the member says, well, but, you know, here's my key argument, well, okay, we presented that key argument. And here's how they responded, and even after hearing that argument, and that is, we have done this and presented this kind of material, and that really does have an impact on people when they see that even after hearing the killer argument, they don't agree. That makes them go stop and really think.
Very interesting. So you believe with this kind of a scientifically selected group of constituents that really is representing the people in their home districts, that members of Congress would vote that way. And I think you're right. The media attention on that could be pivotal.
Yeah. People don't know. I mean, when in a specific, they read a national poll, they go, well, people around here aren't like that, or I don't know if people around here are like that. But when it's completely clear what people around here are saying, even after considering all the ins and outs of the issue, and then that's published locally in the local paper, then it becomes a different ballgame.
Yeah, if the media is willing to hold the members of Congress accountable.
Well, just by publishing it and making it clear, then people will know what other people are thinking, and it'll be a whole new dynamic. It's not
right. What about the other side of this equation here? About the kind of assumption is that policies should be created on what the majority of people believe in and want to have happen. But there are times when the right thing to do is not what the majority says. I mean, you look at the civil rights in the 1950s and 60s. When the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1965, and at the time in the South, there was a lot of opposition to the Civil Rights Act. So if we went based on public opinion then, we might still have Jim Crow laws. So
why do you believe this idea about, go ahead. The thinking is well, you know, who made those decisions? Well, the Supreme Court. And the assumption is that the Supreme Court is sometimes ahead of the public. And this is something we've studied fairly carefully, and that is actually a myth. If you can, all of the changes, the key changes, Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act, at all of those points, a majority of the American public had already made the shift in favor of it.
You're talking about the Supreme Court.
Exactly.
Yeah, but the Civil Rights Act was passed by Congress.
There was a Supreme Court decision that came earlier. There was a Supreme Court decision that. We'll check it out.
I think you're right on the whole.
There was a key Supreme Court decision in the early 50s related to the Civil Rights Act, and then there was Brown versus Board of Education, which occurred earlier.
Uh-huh.
And in both cases, those were preceded by shifts. The majority of the public was already ahead of the curve there. Same thing with gay marriage right now. All the decisions that the Supreme Court has made relative to a gay marriage are, you know, the public is ahead in all of those cases. So yes, we live in a democracy, and it's not that the majority opinion is always the absolute best thing. There's evolution occurring, but the question is, where is the cutting edge, and is the cutting edge more likely to be in the courts or more likely to be in the public? And there really is no evidence that the courts get ahead of the public in these in this evolutionary process.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, and right now we do have the public ahead of the courts on the issue of money and politics. You know, the court's been doing these horrendous decisions about allowing a floodgate of private money to go in unannounced, you know, not transparent about who's funding or where into our elections. And the people are going, hey, wait a minute, what about our democracy? If we're going to be bought, we should at least know who's buying it. So I agree that often public opinion is ahead of the Supreme Court in a good way. But there are definitely times when the majority opinion is not ahead. I mean, more recently we saw similar dynamic with the, you know, with the gay marriage thing that you mentioned. A majority of voters in California, of all places, voted down Proposition 8 and voted down the gay marriage. So there are times when a majority vote, particularly, you know, in the South around things, around African-American equal rights and so forth, that the majority of people are actually on the wrong side of an issue. So what do you do when the majority of the citizens' cabinet is on the wrong side and says, actually, we think we should reinstate poll taxes on people and we should have photo identification requirements for every voter? What do you do in that kind of a situation?
Yeah, I'm not saying that the majority opinion is inherently the voice of God or something. The question is, on what basis do we make decisions? And a democracy is based on the idea that that the majority should prevail. And what we see right these days is that Congress, our government, is not fulfilling what the majority wants on many issues because of the special interests. Now, there are times where the courts will step in and protect the rights of minorities against the even if the majority would favor it. But as I say, the idea that the courts represent in our history that the courts have actually been ahead of the curve when it comes to the majority, that's actually a myth. The majority is always leading the way. And yes, we're always evolving. The society is always evolving. Usually, you know, in almost every case, the change occurs in the public as a whole, not in some elite part that, you know, gets through, knows the right answer.
Yeah, I agree. We've got a democracy that says the majority should prevail, with the caveat that we also need and have a constitution that protects the rights of the minorities. So as long as we keep that full picture in mind, we should be in pretty good shape.
No, but it's really, there's another really important part, and that's what the policymaking simulations are key for. The process by which this evolution occurs in society is one where people deliberate, they think about all the sides of the issue, and the more they think about it, the more they take the different perspectives into account, then things develop and move forward. The idea with the citizen cabinet is that you get a representative sample of the people and who go through this rather intensive process, and then we see where they come out, and they, in a sense, can present back to the public a sense of where people would come out if they had the chance to go through this in-depth process. And then this policymaking simulation is already also put online so that anybody who wants to can go through the process, go through the, you know, all the deliberations and see where they come out as well. So it creates a context for us to think through a big issue. I mean, most people, they go, okay, well, there's a problem with Social Security, but I don't really know exactly how it works or what the options are. But yeah, something ought to be done. You can hear too from politicians, they say, well, people say they want to balance the budget, but when you ask them, do you want to raise taxes? They don't really want to raise taxes. And if you ask them if you want to cut spending in all these different areas, they don't really want to, because they haven't had a chance to think it through and balance out all the different options. But when they do, they actually do cut the deficit quite a lot. So what you're doing is creating a context for people to really think through the issue. And it's not just a process where people are having off-the-cuff responses. And then it's a space that people can go into and have vetted facts where they're hearing all of the arguments from all the different sides. And then we can all kind of move into taking the next step that's needed.
Yeah, it's a fascinating model, and I really appreciate you doing it and coming on the show and explaining it to me and to our listeners. One of the thoughts that comes to me is, you know, say, assume that you are successful and you set up these citizen cabinets in some of the states and some of the districts, and they actually are getting the attention of the members of Congress, and so now then the citizen cabinets become a power center. How can you ensure that the citizen cabinets won't be co-opted by money and become part of the whole problem of what originally started as something for the people's voice to be heard, but then ends up becoming another vehicle co-opted by the Koch brothers or other corporate funders?
Mm-hmm. Well, the oversight board is bipartisan. The process by which we develop the citizen cabinets and so on is done in consulting people from both sides of the aisle, from both parties. Everybody has to buy into it, right? Everybody has to sign off. It's really hard to see how exactly you're going to skew that process when there's so many forces that have to agree to everything that goes into it.
So you think the oversight, you're talking about a national oversight board?
Yeah, and which includes former members of Congress from both parties, leading survey researchers, some of the most Experienced survey researchers in the country are on the oversight board. So it's includes people from the whole spectrum of opinion, liberals, conservatives. So it's and you know, if somebody thinks that it's getting out of balance, then we try to say, okay, what do you think is included in here that should be included? Think of it like it's like a debate. You go to a debate, and each side gets to make their arguments and make rebuttals and so on. Mm-hmm. That's the basic format, is that you're hearing from all sides, the strongest arguments from all sides.
Mm-hmm. And traditionally we've had a problem where the people who have more money often have more influence. How do you balance, power and interests? So how do we make sure you're going to include in there that lower income citizens are fairly represented, that women are there,
how do you make sure that they're
fully represented in this new model?
Yeah, well, that's the design, is that what you have on the citizen cabinet is a mirror of the public as a whole, in terms of income, in terms of gender, in terms of education,
mm-hmm.
In terms of race. All of those things are mirrored in the, it's a little microcosm of the whole population. And we can also break people out. You can break out the women, you can break out the low income people, it's not just giving a voice to the to the whole, it's giving voice to subgroups as well. So everybody can, all of these subgroups will be heard as such too.
Well, it's a fascinating model. I appreciate you developing it. And how can listeners learn more about your work?
Just one more thought. Yeah. What's really surprising is that when people do this, they don't always act simply in terms of their own interests. That's one of the people with higher incomes often support raising taxes, their own taxes, just as much as people with lower incomes. But you can go to VOP.org, that's Voice of the People, and you can sign the petition, you can try out one of the simulations that are there, and you can, after you go through it, you can send a message to your members of Congress summarizing the conclusions that you've come to. You can make a donation. So it's at VOP.org, Voice of the People.
Well, Steve, I admire your steadfast and creative work on behalf of reclaiming democracy in America. Thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.